You're listening to The Perth Property Show, Australia's only weekly property podcast by West Australian experts for West Australian listeners. Catch your latest episode every Monday at 7 a.m.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to The Perth Property Show. My name's Trent Fleskins, your host as always. And as promised, on a quarterly basis, we look back through the questions that have been piling up in our inbox at The Perth Property Show. And we address the most interesting, compelling questions, the ones that reflect most of the other questions that are in the inbox as well. So today we're going to answer 8 questions that do reflect the majority of questions coming in the inbox. And hopefully that will touch on a lot of questions that the listenership is running their mind through at the moment, whether it's understanding where the market's going, what's going on with certain planning policies, or looking at a development strategy and what's going on in Perth right now. So it's just me today on a quarterly basis with our Q&A session. But before we start that, I'll give you a quick update on where the market sits right now. Currently, our transaction numbers on a weekly basis sit around 950 transactions per week. We've been running an average of about that to 1,000 per week for the whole of 2024, and in fact, ever since COVID started. For context, as we always provide, the mining boom was sitting at around 800 transactions per week, and the darkest days we experienced sat down at around 500 to 550 transactions per week in early 2019. So we're currently sitting at about 80% more transactions per week, therefore 80% more demand in our market right now. Supply is sitting well under 4,000 properties on the market right now, and it has been sitting there all year since Christmas. We never thought we'd get to this point. Not even myself thought we'd get below 4,000 properties on the market. A year ago, it was 6,500 properties. The year before that, it was about 9,000 properties. And the darkest days of Perth in 2019, there were about 17,000 properties on the market. So to have less than a quarter of the properties on the market than we did about 5 years ago is just astounding when you reflect that against the weekly demand we are seeing. And it makes sense if we are demanding 950 properties every single week and we're only replacing it with 850 properties a week, then you start to see how that supply on market number dwindles down to just over 3,500 properties on the market right now. And remember, about a third of those is vacant land. So when you've got just over 2,000 properties on the market that you can actually move into straight away and have a roof over your head, that's pretty scary with a population of over 2.5 million people in WA and a population growth of about 90,000 last year, who would need about 50,000 new homes. So on the construction side, we're still only building about 15,000 homes a year. We're approving less than that at the moment, which is the thing that really scares our market right now. It's squeezing people at the bottom of the housing continuum in that social housing and, unfortunately, homelessness space, requiring Minister Kerry to go spend around $100 million in homelessness in the last couple of weeks, which just reflects the issues we have in this market. We shouldn't be having to spend that amount of money on homelessness if we just had enough roofs over everyone's head in the first place. So how do we fix this problem? Well, we've been discussing that over the last 12 weeks, speaking to people like Richard Pappas, James Bennett, Brendan Ptolemy, Emily Young, and many others to really nut out what is going on in this market and what the solutions might be. If you haven't had a listen to those podcasts, I highly recommend you go back and listen to these very insightful conversations that will not only speak to the problems and some of the solutions, but also just some context around where the market is right now, which may give you some confidence about where the market's going. Talking about where the market's going, I've been providing a market update via presentation to a few entities, client bases over the last few weeks, and I've agreed to record that in a webinar over the next week or so that will become available on Strategic Property Group's website at strategicpropertygroup.com.au. If you want to get access to that webinar, which will go through where the market's at, where I believe it's going, then please put your name down in our general contact form on the website there and just type in webinar in the body of the text. We'll then add you to the list to be able to get access to that 30-minute presentation that we'll upload over the next week or so. So, and let's quickly talk about vacancy rates as well. We've just hit a record vacancy rate of around 0.3%. Again, 11,000 properties were available for rent 5 years ago. There's now less than 2,000 properties available for rent. And this is the core of the issue. If you can't get people into the state because they can't rent anywhere, then they can't help with fixing the trade supply issue to build more homes in the first place. And the reason they can't get into the rental market is because people can't get out of the rental market. And we'll talk about that today as well. It's currently an absolute roadblock in that space. And some of these questions we address today from you guys as the listeners will cover a few of the topics today. So let's get into the first question that comes really interestingly from the UK. I want to give a big shout out to Jeff. Jeff listens every week from the UK and is looking to come over to Perth. For everyone else who is not Jeff right now, this is a fantastic example that the government needs to listen to right now. Jeff writes, Hi, Trent. I love the show. I listen from the UK. I'm looking to come over on a 482 visa. I've already got my sponsorship lined up. I've got over 25 years experience running my own construction company. I'm exactly the sort of migrant that you say should be coming over to help fix this problem. I'm married with two kids. However, when we look at coming over and purchasing a property, we will be charged a 7% foreign buyer's surcharge and also $15,000 in fees to buy a house at the median house price right now. That's going to cost us about $60,000 in extra taxes just to go and buy a median house price property in Perth. Now, if we were offshore investors, I would understand that maybe that makes sense. But we're not going to be investors. We want to become Australians, contribute to the economy, pay tax, and be a permanent resident. But that is going to take us 3 to 4 years. So in the meantime, we're either stuck renting in an impossible situation, or we're paying $60,000 in surcharges just to move across and try to be part of the solution. I believe this should be brought to the attention of the powers that be that listen to your podcast. Do you know of any changes on the horizon? Jeff, congratulations to you for reaching out, and you are a perfect example that Minister Safiotti and Minister Kerry and Premier Cook need to sit down and think about. Yes, some people can argue for the foreign buyer surcharge. I certainly can't in any circumstance, because I believe even the investors would be of help to financing the supply of new apartments in our market. But you are a perfect example of a fella who represents the solution we need right now and is absolutely just being kicked in the nuts to think about moving here permanently. And to add to that, the hard thing you're also going to face if you don't have $650,000 plus fees in cash is that Australian banks won't lend to you unless you're a permanent resident as well. Now, that's a really hard pill to swallow. Coming over here, being a part of the solution, wanting to become an Australian, unfortunately, the finance system doesn't support you and the tax system doesn't support you. In fact, tells you you're not welcome. Now, this is a perfect example for everyone listening, leaders and investors alike, to find a way to communicate with our political leaders in WA that whilst we continually say we want to be part of the solution, we're generally offering hurdles for the people who want to be part of the solution. So, Jeff, fantastic email. Thanks for pulling it in, and please keep us updated with how you choose to move forward in your transition to Western Australia. But unfortunately, it seems like Minister Safiotti, our treasurer, just isn't interested at the moment in helping people get out of the rental market by indexing the first home owner's rate of duty to the median house price, or looking at people who genuinely want to become Australians and not charging them a ridiculous surcharge of 7% if they wanted to do so. Sorry, mate. Unfortunately, the update there is no update, and we will continue to push at the advocacy level to give you a fairer crack at moving to Australia. The next question comes from John Tan. John asks, can you please cover the different types of housing per decade in Perth, e.g. the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and so on? Can you have a discussion about the different build quality and styles? John, certainly can, mate. Let's run it from the 40s up to today. So properties in the 40s, essentially post-war properties, you might call them, 40s and 50s, they were pretty similar. A lot of them were built with timber floors at the time, some with concrete, but a lot with timber floors still. A lot of brick veneer, and the way to explain that is that on the outside it was brick leaf, but on the inside and all the internal walls were, other than structural walls, were generally made out of a timber frame with gyprock. Now, a lot of those homes would have already been demolished in Australia. They probably weren't the best construction. Ceiling heights weren't fantastic, and a lot of people aren't a big fan of timber floors with a crawl space underneath, although a lot still exists, and a lot are being renovated these days if they're in good condition. Most of them would have been on 1,000 square meter blocks. You often saw a lot of Californian bungalows as well around your Nedlands, Dalkeith sort of area. Asbestos involved in a lot of these houses. Generally one bathroom and maybe a garage, but often just a carport. When we start moving into the 60s and 70s, you see much more eclectic builds. The houses were actually a little smaller in the 60s and 70s. A lot more project homes come out from the builders. Very similar 3x1s that were brick veneer still, and a bit of an L-shape build. And a lot of people would have seen this through Vic Park, for example, Balga, Nollamara, Westminster, Morley, where you come essentially into the living room, a small living area, a kitchen, normally behind a bit of a nook. Sometimes it's been knocked out already. The floors are generally concrete now, concrete pads, and then you would turn right into a hallway with a laundry, a bathroom, and three bedrooms around it. The backyard would have possibly a sunroom and a bit of a patio at the back. Again, blocks were still about a quarter acre, and you'd also see these in Redcliffe, Belmont, Kewdale, out through the Armidale line. You'd also see these properties in your Hamilton Hill, Spearwood sort of area as well. Now let's move to the 80s. You saw a lot less asbestos in the 80s. Most of the homes from the 80s onwards were just double brick. No more weatherboard, no more brick veneer. You saw double brick homes. In the 80s and 90s really is where you really started to see the bigger four-bedroom homes moving into 4x2s. Garages started to come in. A little bit of al fresco, but certainly every home from then on was really built on a concrete pad. Most of these properties were now a flat block. Department of Planning and Lands at the time were now starting to require the blocks be retained around the block rather than retaining the house. Pre-80s, you saw most of the houses with footings on the house rather than the block. You'll notice that. 80s, 90s, you really see the blocks being retained. So not as much rock retaining going on into the 90s. The 80s still saw through the city of Joondalup in places like Craigie, Padbury, Belden, Heathridge, a lot of rock retaining in the back of the block as the blocks weren't retained themselves. But certainly into the 90s, most of those blocks started to become flat, essentially. The undulation of the land was dealt with retaining around the blocks. Now, the houses certainly got about as big as they'd ever been by that point. If you didn't have a 4x2 in the 90s, you were building a small home. Certainly double garages were the norm now, whereas prior to the 90s, it was generally a single garage, often still a carport. The 90s really represented that time where you started to see at least a 4x2 with a double garage and possibly starting to see a theater come in. Color bond started to creep in through the late 90s into the early 2000s, whereas most of it beforehand was either an asbestos roof or a bristyle clay tile or concrete tile roof. Houses really started to become a lot less ethnic as well. Whereas back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you would really be able to pick that a house was an Italian house or built by an Italian or a Greek or someone from Europe. Certainly moving into the 90s and 2000s, Perth really started to bring on a more of a new vogue modernist view about the way they were designing their homes and valuing light and energy efficiency a little bit more. So as we move into the 2000s, certainly every block in Perth is now retained on the block. There's no asbestos, obviously, from the 80s onwards. Fencing starts to become color bond. The roof really starts to become more color bond than tile as well. And we start to see things like the home theater and the alfresco get built into the home. Block sizes now moved to the 600s and 500s in the 2000s. And the new land estates, places like Canning Vale and Baldivis and Ellenbrook start to open up through the late 90s into the 2000s. And the homes really start getting big. The backyard gets a lot smaller into these times. And the style really is just that classic Australian home where the frontage of the home moves from about 20 meters wide to about 15 at this point in time, and things like sand render start to come in. So you might have a feature brick wall at the front with render around the sides, and if you had a bit more money, you even have render in the alfresco on the back of the house. Your air conditioning starts to move from an evaporative air conditioning to a reverse cycle ducted air conditioning through the early 2000s into the 2010s. We start to see grass trees being used and landscaping really start to pick up, moving away from the kangaroo paws to more the grass trees. The palm trees start to fall away from the 90s and get replaced by fronds and ferns in the plants. The shed starts to get bigger and bigger, and the backyard starts to get smaller and smaller. Frontages in the 2010s start to move to 14, 13, 12, and we're even start to see 9 and 10 meter wide blocks in the new land subdivisions that are popping up in Hammond Park, Belia, Success, Harrisdale, Southern River, Alkimos, Burns Beach. All of these areas really start to come in, and houses again start to become more and more expensive. Back in the 60s, you could build a house for $30,000. We're now in the 2010s building homes for at least $150,000 to $200,000 turnkey, which in today's numbers still seem quite cheap and economical. In this period, we're really knocking trees down as well. As the backyard has become smaller and smaller, we're subdividing properties, we're certainly moving out to urban fringes, and the backyard starts to lose a lot of those big eucalyptus and jarrah trees simply because people don't want to have to deal with it in their gutters. Most of the roofing is now color bond. Most of the houses are now rendered or have a really nice feature brick, and cladding starts to come in as well. And into the late 2010s and today, the standard ceiling height becomes 30 to 32 course, when 28 is really a budget number, whereas before that was standard. Reverse cycle air conditioning is standard. Stone bench tops are standard, whereas laminate was the standard back before the early 2000s. You definitely had two bathrooms. You're possibly looking for a third car bay. A theater is also standard, and a lot of two-story houses really start coming through over the last 10 years. And that becomes the standard, with townhouse living coming through. So hopefully that's characterized it. What we're really seeing is bigger houses, smaller blocks, less trees, and councils that are starting to focus on the protection of those trees, basements, rooftop terraces, people really start to value the amenity in their home rather than the local park or driving to the city or the local shopping center. John, I know that was a big answer, but that's the characterization for everyone listening of how things have progressed in Western Australia over the last 60 years. Let's move on to the next question. James asked the question, can a strata legally prevent a unit or dwelling from operating as an Airbnb? Can a council legally prevent a unit dwelling from operating as an Airbnb? Yes, it happens all the time. You have a strata council that essentially sets the strata agreement. Let's use those layman's terms, where everyone that joins that strata in that apartment building, let's call it, or a triplex, for example, is given that agreement when they're signing to purchase the property with the full understanding these are the laws. This is what you can and can't do in this strata. And let's call it an apartment building for now. So there'll be certain apartment buildings that will allow short stay accommodation, such as Airbnb, and certain stratas that have voted as a council that they don't agree, that they don't allow it, and certain councils, local governments that don't allow it. Now, that's not stopping you doing it, but it certainly means that you could be breaking some rules there if you do that and face fines and penalties. So the first thing I'll be doing if I was looking at getting into Airbnb as an investment strategy before buying an apartment or a unit is making sure that it hasn't been blacklisted as an accommodation type in that particular strata body. Thanks for that question, James. The next question comes from Kai. Kai asks, we are currently renting in Willerton and are looking to buy somewhere. We've got $650,000 to spend on a 3x1 or thereabouts with a plan to renovate for profit. Where should we be looking for short-term capital growth that will support the spend on the renovation? We've had a look in Coolblah. Is that a good option? Kai, thanks for the question, mate. You're budgeting there essentially the median house price, which is good. It gives you half the properties in the metro area to look at. And a 3x1 is generally where most people would go for renovation because they're really not paying for much house value anymore, given it's depreciated to the greatest extent. And people are simply looking for a roof over their head now. So they will compromise to a 3x1. I probably wouldn't bother with a structural renovation to make it a 4x2 if you're ever thinking about that. That's going to cost you serious money in today's market. But right now, that opportunity certainly is, as we spoke with Lachlan Delahunty at the start of the year about, in buying ugly ducklings in markets that are certainly in that affordability zone that Brendan Tolany was talking about, where there is a lot of upside for people to afford the renovated property you're looking to sell and clear value. Now, I've always said in renovations, you make money when you buy. Most of the profit is essentially made when you buy that ugly duckling at a price lower than what the market would be saying. So I wouldn't probably be spending $650. I'd hope to try and find something in the 400s or even 500s and then spend the rest of that budget you've got on trying to turn it into a property that's worth something in the 700s. Now, it certainly could be available in a Coolblah. A lot of people go to the city of Rockingham and the city of Armidale right now, even the city of Kwinana, to do that strategy as well. Some would suggest that there's opportunities in places like Lockridge, Beachborough, in the city of Swan, and in the city of Joondalup. You'd have to get lucky to find a property, I think, that doesn't already have 20 offers on it in original condition, given most of those properties actually are still even 80s original properties in not bad condition. So that's where I'd be going, and that would be my advice, Kai. Next question. Adam asks, Trent, can you spend a bit of time, please, talking about your views on the established unit and apartments market in 2024 and where you think things are going? And my logic for this as a strategy is that given not many apartments are actually getting developed at the moment or in the foreseeable future because of build costs, surely this undersupply and this dwelling type will send the price of established units and apartments through the roof. And Adam, you're not wrong here. The theory that when a certain housing type is not able to be supplied to the market at the current price, which then leads to the established market rising, has 100% just happened in the fully detached housing space. So we saw, for example, in Ellenbrook, established home worth $450,000, rising significantly because the new home next door would have cost $550,000 to $600,000 to rebuild. So what happens? The buyers in that market go, well, I'm not going to build. I don't see any value in that decision. I'm going to buy the $450,000 property and renovate it if I need to, because I'm going to make a win there in addition to the fact that I don't have to wait 2 years to move in with all the risk that comes with that in the last few years. So what that's done is put all of the demand towards that established market, market, and eventually it's actually started to reach parity now, where people are finally now starting to make that equal decision again, looking at it as an equal opportunity of maybe I will build now. And that's starting to balance that established market out in those house and land areas. The same thing is happening in the apartment space. So for a couple of reasons. One, affordability. A lot of suburbs now, the only affordable product for the buyer is a unit or an apartment. Two, rental yields. Investors are looking at apartments now that they've really swarmed through the detached houses and the townhouses. They're now going to apartments seeing 5% rental yield and going, you beauty, I'll buy a couple of those. That's sending prices on apartments, even in places like East Perth and West Perth, up now. Finally, after a decade of slumping by significant numbers, they're still below replacement value. That is the point. You can buy a utilitarian 2x2 apartment that will rent out for $650, $750 a week in East Perth now, and you could still buy it in the $400, some of these. So give it a lick of paint, renovate it, and your rent could be even more. But to be frank, what you're simply doing is buying under replacement cost, because that new product down at the end of East Perth is selling for $650,000, $700,000 at least. It's not my housing type that I like to invest in. However, if you're looking for a yield, if you're looking for a passive investment and some upside in that market, for the reasons I've explained, you will see some growth there. And to quickly mention how long that market will be available, well, I can tell you, as we've spoken about many times this year and last year on the podcast, the apartment market is so far away from being able to service the median house price suburbs in Perth, let alone get the financing approved for it, that we are a good 4 or 5 years away, I believe, before there's any competition of new supply in those suburbs like Bayswater, Cannington, Coburn Central, these sort of areas, before we see material supply coming on competing with the established market. So there we go. There's a lot of space there for people to get into that market if that is the only place that they can afford, or if that's just where their risk profile sits. Thanks for the question, Adam. Next question comes from Janine. Janine asks, hey, Trent, you updated us recently about the medium density code coming in with Aaron Seiss, with Emily Young. What do you think about it? Obviously, you weren't a big fan of it coming in last year. It seems to have simply been deferred for 6 months with minimal changes. That's my view. Well, Janine, you're not wrong. To be frank, I'm not a massive fan of you of the big parts of the medium density code that were really a bugbear for a lot of people in the small scale developer industry, especially around site coverage and setbacks. Whilst there are some benefits to the medium density code, such as the small dwellings, auxiliary dwellings options, the restrictions that are now placed on site coverage in your standard triplex suburbs now essentially render suburbs third and fourth quartile for prices in WA. Let's talk your Westminsters, Balgas, Coolblops. It really has restricted the product that can go in there now. Now, what it means is that you're really only going to be able to fit either a duplex where there was a triplex, or townhouses where the market can't actually afford to buy that product given the cost of it. So what we're going to see essentially is a lot of the established market in these suburbs where the triplexes that have been approved have been already built start to really increase in value, because there will be no more of that coming out for a very long time, because the next wave will only be really townhouses, and that is so far away from being able to be affordable or competitive in these markets that are essentially offering $450,000 to $550,000 established units right now. A townhouse will have to sell for at least $700,000 to make it profitable to the developer. So we're going to see a big undersupply of infill for years to come, which will force prices up in the cheapest suburbs in Perth until eventually that's just where parity hits, as we spoke about before with James. And what it's essentially doing is forcing the increase of prices for what should be the cheaper alternatives in dwellings in WA. This is what happens when you let elitist ideological mindsets steer the course of our future in planning. I believe the market should decide built form. If the market didn't want to move into triplexes and would prefer to live in townhouses, it would pay for it and it would talk with its money. And unfortunately, what it's going to create is a bunch of gaps in our market that will affect first home buyers and those on lower wage brackets. So the median density code is out now. It does restrict a lot of what small scale developers used to do in a time that already restricts price points in the first place. What we're going to see is a forced move towards townhouses in order to have slightly larger backyards and some more trees in backyards. So let's see how that rolls out. Okay, the last question for today comes from Daryl. Daryl writes, Trent, another show I listen every week. One thing that I want to hear from you is a bit of a rundown on the current investment strategies in Western Australia. Which ones are working, which ones aren't, which ones are you focusing on right now? Daryl, great question. One we probably don't answer directly enough on this podcast, given all the advocacy and updates we are trying to provide. But to get straight to the point, let's talk about the different ways you can invest in property. The first one with the lowest risk profile for someone looking to buy in the market would actually just be buying a family home. How can that be an investment, Trent? Well, I'll tell you how. It might not be viewed as an investment property with the ATO. You may not be paying tax on it, but that's the point. In that, for a lot of people who aren't savvy in property, who simply recognize that the market's doing well and want to make sure that they're not falling behind financially, the best outcome can often be simply buying the best family home in the best area they can afford. Why? Well, because the family home is the only tax-free investment you'll ever make in your life. Now, you may not be claiming deductions on the family home, but the benefit to maximizing the value of your family home and therefore maximizing your exposure to this market is that for every dollar you make in that family home, whether you stay for a couple of years or you stay for 20 years, you're paying no tax. You compare that to the investment property you could have bought, maybe your effective tax rate is 30, 40%. Every dollar your family home is making is working that much harder for you. So before you go and buy an investment property for the sake of it, just to say around the dinner table that you've got an investment property, think about whether you've maximized the value potential of the house you would actually want to live in. You, one, gain the benefit of being able to live in the best area you can afford, but two, do it knowing that you'll never pay tax on the value gain in that property in the first place. The best areas I see that happening is actually not in the metro area. It's often in the urban fringes. Places like Henleybrook, for example, people have made serious money in the last few years buying a property pre-rezoning for $1 million and selling it now for $2.5 million. That $1.5 million in the space of 10 years is tax-free. So if you were to extrapolate that out these days, you might see people buying properties, let's say 5 acres in Oakford or Darling Downs or Cardup, these sort of areas where clearly rezoning is happening on the fringes there. If you're happy to live in those areas, enjoy the big open spaces, you'll eventually be rewarded handsomely tax-free for controlling assets that land developers, for example, can make some money on in the future. So whether it's the semi-rural property on the urban fringes or it's simply just the nicest, coolest place you can find in the best suburb you'd want to bring your kids up in, that tax-free environment is actually something that helps you really insulate whether it's a fantastic investment or not in the family home. So let's move forward then to the next strategy. Well, that would simply just be a passive property investment. And what I mean by that is simply buying a property that you're going to rent out. There's no development strategy, there's no renovation strategy. How is that market going right now? Well, it really depends on where you've been. If you've been buying investment properties at the lower end of town, anywhere below $800,000 in the last 4 years, then you've probably made 50% in that 4 years. If you're in the city of Armidale, Rockingham, Kwinana, you've made about 30% in the last 12 to 18 months, all based on the affordability factor and prices being pushed up by investors seeking a yield, a lot of them from the East Coast. Now, if you bought 10 properties in Armidale 18 months ago and that was worth $3 million, you would have turned that into $4 million in the space of a year. If you bought a $3 million house in the western suburbs, it's possible you actually wouldn't have made that much in that time. So again, it all comes down to where in Perth right now, and the money really is currently, due to interest rates, around that $400,000 to $800,000 mark. Now that will eventually, as I've said recently, ripple back up the price points, and it will be triggered the second we see interest rates start to drop and people can afford to move up in the socioeconomic quartiles, as we've discussed before as well. How long that lasts? Well, we believe there's so much underlying fundamentals in this market. Values will continue to grow across the board at varying rates. Rents will continue to rise as well. Most people would actually probably be around neutrally geared, if not positively geared in the lower ends, slightly negatively geared in the higher ends in terms of prices right now. Let's move then to a renovation strategy. I'd say that's probably the next one up from there. A lot of renovations are happening right now, especially in those local governments I just mentioned, where you've got stock that's 60s, 70s, 80s, 3x1s, 4x1s, possibly 4x2s, really run down and in a perfect price point to push something from low to mid 400s into high 500, early 600, simply with a lick of paint, new floor, air conditioning, new tiles and new landscaping. Now, people are making $50,000 to $100,000 on this strategy, but I would think that a lot of this is actually simply just being time in the market, good buying, and then getting out without too much cost. The real key to a renovation is that you're not in too long and you're not paying too much in interest, because the costs of getting in and out of property really are quite expensive, as we know, stamp duty, selling fees, and so on. Next from there, it would be the small-scale developments. So whether that's a house behind a house or a triplex, those sort of developments that most investors who have exposure to a couple of properties would now start to be looking at. That really has been a strategy that's worked for a lot of people over the years. Our business, Strategic Property Group, is founded on that strategy, having managed over 120 projects for clients in this space over the years. We haven't been in that space so much recently, and the reason for that is because the price of entry is so high, the cost of development in the small scale has risen so quickly, and the sales values haven't actually risen as quickly as the cost. So where we used to be able to find projects at 15 to 20% return on cost, we're now seeing most feasibilities sit at around 3 to 7%, which really isn't the sort of feasibility that would have us push ahead for our clients. So those projects where people have purchased and started and signed a build contract back in 2021, those guys are making some serious profits. We're talking up to $1 million here, where a lot of the triplex units have gone up $250,000 each in that time, on top of the profit we believed we'd have in the first place. But these days, if you were to buy that property now, look to build at today's build costs, profits just aren't showing what we'd like them to for us to press go. On the smaller side of things, the house behind a house, it's a much tougher environment. There's a lot more work involved there. You are paying premiums, competing with owner-occupiers just looking for a roof over their head. And the value of that block at the back hasn't increased in the same way we would have liked to, simply because of the cost to build on top of that at some point for the end buyer. So that strategy, again, not as easy. You need a lot of cash to do a house behind a house subdivision, paying for all the headworks, paying for the new drive, surveying fees, demolition fees, everything involved there. And it normally will also require renovation of the front house. So at the moment, we've actually found that just passively holding property has ended up being the best outcome for a lot of clients in the last couple of years, with a lot less stress, a lot less risk, while still keeping the optionality of being able to develop at some point in the future when the numbers do stack up. So that's probably the spectrum there of most people's investment options that are listening, I would suggest. People above that, moving into those larger commercial spaces, well, industrial has done really well in the last few years. If you could find a block to actually build a warehouse on, that's probably been the limiting factor. Childcare centers have done their dash for the most part. It's really the savvy buyer and developer who can find the right location at the right price these days, as a lot of proved centers have now been mothballed before construction starts. And it's probably the larger land developers now, the big land development companies, that are making most of the wins at the moment, given land prices have now spiked up in the last 6 to 12 months. They're really starting to do well, moving house and land packages again. So there's a spectrum of development options right now. We won't talk about apartments because we know that's not happening for 99% of developers out there. When they do, we'll certainly be talking about it again. Guys, I think we're already hit our time limit today in terms of our Q&A session. Again, I will be recording a webinar in the next week or so. If you're interested in having a look at that, please go on to our website, strategicpropertygroup.com.au. Pop your name into the contact form, type in webinar, and we'll make sure you're on the list with that email sent out for my 30-minute update as to where the market is. Thanks for listening, guys. Chat to you next week.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Perth Property Show. If you've only just joined the conversation, you can catch up by heading over to our website, perthpropertyshow.com.au, subscribing to the podcast, or joining our Facebook page. Don't forget to tune in next Monday at 7 a.m. for more expert insights, local analysis, and suburb spotlights. Happy hunting!